It's Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled on several key cases, including whether the census will ask about citizenship. We'll get the details.
First, summer is upon us, but as we know here in Wisconsin, it's not going to last long, so it's time to soak up the sunshine while it lasts.
With the sunshine comes days at the beach, hikes outside, and ice cream trucks staking out their claim in your neighborhood, but there's also a bounty that the summer brings.
Vegetables, as it so happens, love June and July as much as we do. From corn, avocados, zucchini to tomatoes, these are all at their freshest during the summer months.
And here to talk with us now about how to make summer veggies shine during your next meal is Aaron Alderson. Aaron is a cookbook author and founder of the vegetarian cooking website NaturallyElla.com. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me again.
So from a veggie perspective, how great of a season is summer?
It's amazing. I mean, you really can't go wrong with almost anything that's growing right now.
And, you know, every season has their stars. You know, in December, you might have really great kale. What to you stands out the most about, the summer months?
That's a tough question.
Sorry, putting you on the spot.
No, I just feel like there's so many good things. Tomatoes, obviously. Tomatoes are just one of those things that I rarely buy out of season because they just taste so good during the summer. But I also have a really soft spot for sweet corn and green beans, too.
Yeah, those are pretty common. Not common, but tomatoes in the winter taste basically like hard water at that point.
Yep.
So totally I'm with you there on the tomatoes and the corn specifically.
So, Aaron, tell us about some tips to find that great produce. We see it this time of year at produce stands. We see it at the farmer's market. It's also at the grocery store. But what should we be looking for to make sure that we're getting the freshest ingredients during the summer?
I think for most items, color is a really good assessment. Just making sure that it has, it's very vibrant colors this time of year. And then also with a lot of ingredients, making sure that it's crisp or that it has a really nice, I'm thinking specifically with green beans, you want to make sure that there's a good color and a nice crispness to them. Tomatoes, you want them to be just kind of firm, not super soft, with really good color all around. And I find that just going to the farmer's market a lot too is amazing this time of year because the markets are overflowing and it's great to talk to the farmers and they can often point out some more tips as well.
Yeah, I want to stick with the farmers market because we have a huge one and we are full of farms in Wisconsin and farmers markets are huge throughout the state. People might be a little bit nervous talking to their vendors at a farmers market. How should people maybe engage with the people they're buying their veggies from?
I think just asking kind of simple questions like, what's the best way to look at this produce or, do they have any tips for cooking it up or how they like to serve it? Or, I find that a lot of times, as long as, the farmer's market isn't overly crowded, that the people running the booth really love to chat about what they're doing because they have their hands in the dirt. They know what's going on with everything.
It seems like summer vegetables are some of the most versatile things that you can cook with, and there are certainly times in the summer where it's hot outside. This weekend sounds like it's going to be a scorcher here in Wisconsin. The last thing I want to be doing is standing in front of the stove and cooking something up, but these are ingredients that you could easily throw in a salad or maybe a cold noodle dish. Talk about how versatile summer produce can be.
Yeah, I really try hard not to turn my oven on. I'm in California in Sacramento and the summer is 110 degrees. And so turning the oven on just really isn't an option, but there is so much you can do. Tomatoes are great raw. Cucumbers are something that we haven't mentioned yet. Also, amazing. I'll just slice cucumbers and eat them for a snack with a little bit of hummus. And I could live on that practically all summer. Peppers, sweet corn, even zucchini. I won't cook sometimes. I'll shave zucchini and toss it with a yogurt sauce as a cold kind of optional pasta dish that is just lovely. So there's so much you can do on the stovetop. Also grilling vegetables. I feel like a lot of people feel that turning on your grill for vegetables doesn't necessarily compute, but I love throwing any kind of vegetable on the fire and seeing what I get.
I want to talk more about that because I recently fired up my grill, and normally when I do, I'm thinking, okay, brats, I'm thinking ribs, I'm thinking burgers, and I had an experience recently where I just grilled some, I grilled up some peppers, and I also took foil packets, and I grilled up some pineapple. I don't think that was fresh in season in Wisconsin, but it was pretty good, with just some cinnamon and some brown sugar, and that cooked up really nicely. So there's really, it sounds like, a lot that you can do on the grill that doesn't involve meat.
Correct. Totally. One of my favorites is grilled zucchini, because I feel like both with zucchini and summer squash, you can easily overcook it until where it's like mushy and not very good. But grilling it just creates this perfect char either on the strip. I usually cut it lengthwise and grill it with just a little bit of olive oil and salt, and it's just perfect because it has a nice char but still retains a little bit of texture. Same with sweet corn. Sweet corn on the grill. I mean, I grew up boiling sweet corn, and to have sweet corn off the grill is amazing as well.
We're talking to Erin Alderson right now. She's a cookbook author and founder of the vegetarian cooking website, NaturallyElla.com. And I completely agree with you, certainly on the corn front, having spent a big chunk of my childhood in Indiana, that is pretty much a staple all year round. I don't know how we do it, but the summer is when it is the best. What are some unexpected ways, maybe I'm going to put you on the spot again, to outside of grilling corn, serving corn?
Raw, I think, is probably one of the more unexpected ways. I know people are like, oh, raw sweet corn, but it's really nice in salads. Again, kind of going back to that idea of like a noodle bowl, even grain bowls. I'm being vegetarian developer of recipes. I rely a lot on grains and doing whole grain bowls with a sauce, some vegetables, whether cooked or raw. And a lot of times with sweet corn, I'll do just like a little sweet corn tomato mix with just some olive oil, basil, and salt. And I mean, that's kind of summer in a quick recipe.
I remember we did a segment on the Ideas Network once about, it was just a caller segment, how do you prepare corn? And you want to talk about issues that got people fired up? That was the one. We had people calling in with all kinds of different methods, and no one could seem to agree on any given one. But that seems like it's the beauty of cooking things like corn. It doesn't necessarily matter which way you go about it. It sounds like often you're going to end up with a delicious result.
You are, as long as you get the silk out of the corn. No one wants to eat the silk.
Yeah, I feel like getting like teeth full of that sometimes when you haven't shucked it properly is just a nightmare, and you're kind of picking it out at your barbecue. We're talking specifically about, you know, vegetarian cooking, because that is the basis of your website. You know, a lot of people are going to be cooking out this summer, and as Chris mentioned earlier, it's, when you think about grilling, you think about brats or ribs. How do you bring maybe meat eaters to the vegetarian table when you're cooking out?
I avoid like frozen veggie patties because I feel like that's what people automatically assume I'm going to serve them. And so I rely really a lot on salads. Again, kind of going back to the grain bowls, pasta dishes. It's really nice to be able to, you can throw pasta on your stovetop and then grill everything else out and combine it with a simple sauce, and you have this amazing main course of lots of veggies. And so I think it's just making sure that what you're doing has flavor to it and that it's robust enough, whether you're using grains or beans or lentils. I really like to mix up a lot of what I'm doing with the vegetables to make sure that I want people to eat it and go, oh, this is delicious, and then go, oh, wait a minute, there's not meat in this.
And it sounds like you want people to treat the vegetarian option at the potluck or the barbecue not as a side dish, but as the main course. So can you talk about making a veggie dish, you know, your strategies to really make it a satisfying main course?
So this is where I rely a lot on legumes. I just did a dish this past weekend where I grilled carrots and I tossed it in a romesco sauce and I served it over a white bean puree. And I mean, it was the first dish to go and everyone was like, oh, this is so delicious. You know, what was in this? And primarily bringing it all together was the bean puree. And no, I mean, sometimes I get scoffed at when I'm like, no, just eat beans whole, because a lot of times people who aren't used to that, it can be a little bit of a mouthful for them. And so I find bringing in these creative ways, like using a bean puree or doing lentils as a topping instead of the main component, or nuts and seeds too, are also a really great addition to meals to kind of round out where some of the protein from the meat might be missing.
It is Food Friday here on Central Time, and we are talking with Erin Alderson about summer vegetarian dishes.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are some of your favorite vegetarian dishes? Are there veggies you wish you knew how to cook a little better during the summer months? Do you have questions about seasonal cooking? Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. It's Food Friday, and we continue our conversation with cookbook author and food blogger Erin Alderson about how to take advantage of the best produce summer has to offer.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are you curious about when it comes to vegetarian cooking? Have you found dishes you especially like during the summer? And do you have any questions about adding more veggies to your meals this summer? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of email, we have an email comment from Grant who says, "Summer corn with fresh tomato and onion in a salsa is unbeatable." Grant, I am with you. That sounds great. Erin, how about that suggestion, cooking with salsa with fresh veggies in the summer?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think that sounds delightful, and I could totally see that. So one of the things that I love to grill out is halloumi. For anyone who's not familiar with that, it's a Greek cheese that stays firm when you cook it, and you can easily grill it. And I love making halloumi tacos, and that salsa sounds perfect for topping that taco.
I'm also a big halloumi fan, so hearing that is like really piquing my interest about things to do this summer, right?
I've never heard of it, and
I'm
totally inadequate, but I'm glad I'm here. Anyways, continue talking without me.
Yeah, so you're done. Just kidding. Chris will be back. But you did send along some recipes to us that we get to share, and so I want to get into that a little bit. You have a tomato harissa salad with farro, and it seems like it's sticking a little bit with that grain bowl that you've been talking about. It sounds really fresh, but let's break this down a little bit for those who aren't familiar. Can you explain what harissa is just to start?
So it is a kind of an herby spice sauce from, if I'm testing me, putting me on the spot, I want to say North Africa is the...
I think that's correct, yeah.
Yes, where the sauce originated, but it is full of herbs and toasted spices, a little bit of heat, and it's just one of those things that I could literally put on everything, and I do when I make it. And so it's just one of those sauces that can bring things together with the fresh tomatoes and the grains. And I find that I pack this salad for lunches or picnics. We're always heading off for the weekend, and so these are the kinds of things that I like to throw in the cooler because it can easily sit. It actually gets better as it sits, and it's just a really great salad.
And I've got to confess, I've got a jar of harissa in my refrigerator that I used about, you know, 2 tablespoons from once to cook some salmon, and it's just been sitting there ever since. So this is kind of speaking to me. It sounds like this ingredient is maybe a lot more versatile than what I'm thinking right now.
Oh, yeah. It's one of my favorite pantry staples. So I believe that the recipe is using a green version, which is a little bit more herby. And you can buy harissa at the store that's in jars. And I have to warn you that it does get a little spicy. And so it's just one of those things that you want to taste ahead of time before you just start mixing it into all your ingredients. But I love using it. I'll make a yogurt dip or sauce with it where I just literally mix it right into the yogurt. I'll toss it with pastas. I'll add it to soups. It's something that I can't live without in my kitchen.
Yeah, I related to that because I was at the farmer's market a few weeks ago prior to Mother's Day because I was going to have my mom and my mother-in-law over and I was going to cook the salmon dish with the harissa. And I tried the harissa at the farmer's market and boy, am I glad I made that decision because that was spicy. And what I definitely didn't want was anyone overheating at Mother's Day brunch. So luckily that didn't happen. I went with some store-bought stuff that was just a little bit cooler. Well, speaking of things that are a little bit cooler, you've also shared with us a recipe for cucumber avocado spring rolls. Tell us about what inspired this dish.
So living in California, obviously, I get access to fresh avocados. And so this time of year, it is California avocado season. So we use a lot of those, but hopefully they get shipped to the Midwest as well. But it's fresh. It has the fresh cucumber, has the fresh avocado. And this also has a little bit of tofu in it, which could easily be thrown on the grill. So this becomes a meal that you can make without even touching your oven. And again, it's one of those things that I like to pack away, take on a hike with me, and it's nice and portable. it's just a perfect summer dish too.
Yeah, and avocados in particular, we do have them in the Midwest. They are very popular. We're all millennials, so we're familiar with avocado toast.
Been outed.
Yeah, sorry to our listeners. However, for some people who might want to try avocados, what are the best things to look for when they're at the grocery store? Since for some people, myself included, finding a perfect avocado feels like the Holy Grail at times.
And you kind of touched on exactly how you do it. It's all by feel, too. I found that what I do is I look for ones that are a little deeper in color, specifically Haas. There are many different varieties of avocado, and some take different ways of telling when they're ripe. But for the normal Haas avocado that you'd find in the grocery store, I just hold it and I just gently squeeze it. Not too hard. And you want to have it just be soft. You want to have it be a little give, but not so much that it feels mushy inside, and not so hard that there is no give. And so it's all by feel.
And so this is a recipe for a cucumber avocado spring roll. There are two of us here at this hosting table, and one of us doesn't like cucumber. I'm not going to say which one. So I'm wondering, is this something where we could substitute something like zucchini in place of cucumber, or is that not going to work?
Oh, no, you totally could. And you could do raw zucchini. I would just ribbon it, put it, or zoodles. I know zoodles are really popular. I actually don't like that term, but I'm going to use it. This is also a really good place where you could grill some strips of zucchini and put it in with the tofu as well.
That sounds delicious. I'm going to try this certainly with a zucchini. But we're not going to say who doesn't like cucumbers at the table. And I want to remind everyone that we're talking to Erin Alderson. She's a cookbook author, and she's the founder of the vegetarian cooking website Naturally Ella. And we're talking about some recipes about how to best use your summer produce bounty. And another one, speaking of zucchinis, is a turmeric zucchini bowl. Also a spice that might not be in everyone's cupboard, but more people are getting on the turmeric train. Can you tell us a little bit about this dish?
Like I mentioned earlier, really love grain bowls, and this zucchini dish is so simple. It's a basic sauce, a little bit of zucchini, I think almonds for a little bit of texture, mm-hmm. and I serve it over quinoa because, again, that's another great way to kind of round out the meal. Quinoa is a quick cooking grain, so is the zucchini, and I believe this bowl's ready in about 25, 30 minutes. So it's one of the weeknight staples in our house during the summer.
I also am curious if there's any interesting kitchen gadgets or anything that you use or would recommend to really encourage vegetarian cooking, because I think the thing that did it for me was actually getting a spiralizer, which then led to me making zucchini noodles. We're not going to call them the other thing, but it really kind of opened up a new world to me. So I'm curious if there are any gadgets in your kitchen that you would recommend.
Ooh. I try to limit my kitchen gadgets. I know there's tons of corn shuckers and avocado pitters, and you could go crazy getting all sorts of little gadgets for dealing with vegetables. But I find, my most used thing in my kitchen is my chef's knife. And so if I have to recommend one thing, it's that making sure you have a good sharp knife, because that's the only way you're going to get through some of these veggies.
I'm going to put you on the spot again. This is clearly quiz time with Erin Alderson. But for a lot of people, too, who are trying to eat more vegetables, they'll go for a CSA. For people who aren't necessarily sure about some mystery vegetables that they get in this box, since they don't get to pick, what are some recommendations for you about how people might tackle these unexpected vegetables?
I think just popping onto Google and just doing a quick search, because there's really no vegetable out there now that someone hasn't made some amazing recipe for. And at the end of the day, there's hardly any vegetable that I've met that you can't roast, which, during the summer, again, you don't really want to turn your oven on. So try throwing it on the grill. I highly recommend getting a grill pan for some of those smaller things like green beans or diced zucchini, cherry tomatoes. That way you can just throw them on the grill still and they won't go into the grates. But usually, most especially summer vegetables, they don't need a lot. Just a little bit of olive oil, salt, pepper, and you're good to go.
My solution when I encounter a vegetable or I've got just things sitting in the bottom of my refrigerator that need to go somewhere is just tossing it in a stir fry. And I think at the end of summer, I get to the point where I'm a little stir fried out. So I'm wondering if you have any strategies to make stir fries a little bit more exciting or appealing, especially after somebody may have been eating them for 2 months straight.
I like to change them up. So I'll do noodle bowls. And so I'll use like soba noodles or udon noodles and stir fry some veggies and change up the sauce. Helps a lot, too. So, you know, one day I'll do a chili sauce and the next day I'll do a teriyaki sauce. Or if I'm feeling completely over noodle bowls, I'll switch and do like fried rice with egg. And again, another really great way. I have a 4-year-old, and so I'm constantly trying to find ways to make vegetables into tiny bite-sized pieces. So fried rice is a great way to get him involved, and he'll gladly eat that as well.
Part of the reason why we wanted to have you on, Erin, is to talk about, you know, summer vegetables in particular, because they're at their peak, you know, tomatoes, zucchini, all those other things that we've talked about. But some people typically, you know, buy veggies out of season. What are people maybe missing out on when they're not kind of following the seasons?
Flavor. I think that flavor is the biggest thing, because you think, again, I'll go back to tomatoes, where you get a tomato that's been shipped thousands of miles or is just completely not ripe. It's kind of like the worst experience you can have in food is eating something that just doesn't have the same flavor when you know what the flavor's like. And I just feel like summer is such a great time to really embrace what a tomato really tastes like. And that sounds kind of crazy to say, but there really is a flavor difference.
And we only have about a minute left on the program, but we've been talking about vegetables in particular, but summer is also a great time for fruit. What are some of the best fruits that people can be on the lookout for this summer?
Any stone fruit. Peaches, nectarines, plums, anything. And I really love using stone fruit in savory ways, too. I think I'm obsessed with halloumi, and I have a halloumi peach skewer that goes easily on the grill. Salads, stone fruits and salads are amazing. And then berries as well. You can't go wrong with blueberries, blackberries, raspberries.
Well, Erin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Erin Alderson is a cookbook author and founder of the vegetarian cooking website NaturallyElla.com. She joined us today to talk about her favorite summer vegetarian dishes. You can find the recipes we talked about today, including cucumber avocado spring rolls. We also have turmeric zucchini bowls and tomato harissa salad with farro. That's over on WPR.org/Food Friday.
Coming up after the news, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down some key decisions yesterday, including one on gerrymandering. That could have some big implications here in Wisconsin. We'll get the latest in just a moment. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up, it's been 50 years since a police raid on a gay bar in New York City led to riots and played a massive role in modern LGBTQ history. We discuss Stonewall at 50 just a bit.
First, the U.S. Supreme Court released some long-awaited opinions yesterday, including rulings on a citizenship question on the census, gerrymandering, and a Wisconsin case about drawing blood from a drunk driver.
Kimmy King is with us to discuss the decisions released yesterday. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. Kimmy, it's great to have you back on with us on Central Time.
Always good to be back on public radio.
So one of the most anticipated decisions addressed whether the Trump administration could include a question on the upcoming 2020 census asking whether a person responding to the survey is a U.S. citizen. In a 5-4 decision, the court ruled that it could not be added for the first time in well over about 60 years. What did we hear from the majority here?
So what's the most interesting about the case, and has been the most interesting this term, has been the role of Chief Justice John Roberts, because Roberts was critical in that case for providing the fifth vote and the opinion, which sets out the concerns regarding the Trump administration's attempt to place the census question on the upcoming census. And in essence, what the court agreed was they decided not to decide. And that is, they kicked this down the road, saying that there had been insufficient evidence about the agency's decision-making process. And so that's what Roberts wanted to clarify. He was not saying that the Secretary of Commerce could not put a census question on. In fact, if you look back in time, we have had a variation of a census question on there. But since 1950, there has been real reluctance to do it on the broader census survey. And so his concern was that the agency and the Secretary of Commerce, Wilbur Ross, and his attempts to put the census question on there had not provided sufficient justification for doing so. And so that's why it won't be on this census unless they can get that moving quickly.
Do you think that we could see some movement on that, or is this sort of dead in the water currently?
Well, the thing that's difficult is that I don't know how closely folks were following this, but there were documents that have appeared regarding attempts at altering the democratic governance process, and they have been linked clearly to that decision. So it makes it very difficult for the administration to come forward. Additionally, the administration has said that they absolutely had to have a decision out of the court because they need to start printing up and get moving on the questionnaire not later than June. And as you can see, it's tick-tock, tick-tock, time is running out.
This decision in no way, shape, or form was unanimous, even though Justice Roberts sided with the majority here. There were still four more justices that were in the minority and dissented. What was their argument here?
Well, their argument, and you can see that Roberts isn't saying, I'm disagreeing with you on this, in his majority opinion. The minority is concerned that this is something that is left within the domain of the executive, and the executive has this authority, and it's a legitimate question that can be placed and has been placed on the census in the past. They were not as concerned about the sufficiency of the evidence or the motives that might have gone into placing the census question on there. And that really is where the hard line comes between the two.
As you mentioned, it's sort of tick-tock, tick-tock for the Trump administration. President Trump has said that he is looking into ways to get the census, the citizen question on the census. Is there a legal action the administration can take, or where does this stand?
So it's not clear, you know, as you said before, that it's not dead in the water this go-round. What the administration will need to do is to lay the groundwork for why they want to put it on there. And most importantly, the pivotal issue that they had argued was they needed to be able to protect voting rights. But they have that, you know, having this question on there would make clear the protection of those who are eligible for voting. Unfortunately, they don't have any documentation to support that. So they need to lay a groundwork for what that is. And then they also have to overcome dealing with emails and memos and other communications, which seem to indicate that it was trying to shore up political power. I think in the interim, one of the other things, the real reason why it's dead in the water, is that it's incredibly problematic for your large states, especially those that have large immigrant populations. Texas, my state, has said, oh, that's okay, undercount our people. We're okay with that. But other states, not so much. The implication of the census has an impact on billions of dollars over the course of the next decade that your state will receive. It has implications for your representation in the U.S. Congress. And most importantly, as we head into 2020, it has implications for the role you will play in the Electoral College and the selection of the president. And so I think it's really that as people start to digest this and the political impact that adding a census question would have, that will be what ultimately drives the debate as they move forward. And the ability to win that argument is what matters.
We're talking to Kimmy King right now. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas. And we're talking about three cases that the U.S. Supreme Court issued rulings on yesterday. Sticking in the political realm, let's talk about partisan gerrymandering. It's been the subject of two different lawsuits that have made it to the Supreme Court. One is from North Carolina. The other is from Maryland. Can you really quickly tell us about those cases?
So here, once again, Roberts is showing his swing voter colors, and he is going to align this time with the four conservatives. And really, this case is the much more important case regarding gerrymandering. And I think it's also very important to point out that the court was being an equal opportunity employer for slapping back both Democrats and Republicans, because in the Maryland case, you had Maryland Democrats who were targeting Republicans, and in the North Carolina case, you had North Carolina Republicans targeting Democrats. We have a long history and standards clearly provided for how you are to evaluate racial gerrymandering, and racial gerrymandering is prohibited. But what the court has struggled with is coming up with a clear standard for partisan gerrymandering. That is, it's not because of the color of your skin, it's because of your party. Well, when you're looking at modern voting phenomenon, you can clearly see that higher numbers of minorities vote for Democrats and that the Republicans can reliably count on their Anglo counterparts in elections. So the question then becomes, is that racial gerrymandering? Who should decide this? Do the standards from racial gerrymandering automatically apply to partisan gerrymandering? Is there really anything, I think in some ways, wrong about partisan gerrymandering? Because then it is inside the parties, and it was left to the state legislatures under the Constitution. The question is, is that in some ways pretextual? You are using partisanship as a pretext for why you're doing what you're doing. And so it's really just kind of racism hiding behind the party, right? That's the argument. And so what Robert said is, we're not going to have any of it. You know what? The federal courts should not be involved in this. The federal courts should stay out. This is a political question. Which, when most people hear political question, you think, oh, every question before the Supreme Court is a political question. But when the Supreme Court says political question, they mean a question reserved to another branch of government. And so what Roberts did was to say, this is a political question. The federal court should stay in their lane. We are going to push it back to the states. They need to come up with standards regarding partisan gerrymandering. Indeed, a number of states have already started doing that because of all the issues and the litigation costs associated with gerrymandering cases. They were proactive, and Robert said, we're going to leave it there, and we're going to stay over here. So in that sense, it is a win for conservative Republicans. Just understand that in the case itself, it absolutely targeted both Democrats and Republicans.
In this vein still, Justice Elena Kagan was one of the authors of the dissent. It was pretty blistering. And she said democracy is basically at stake, unless I'm mistaking what she wrote.
No. In fact, in what I would call a fierce dissent, she accused the Roberts majority of being anti-democratic and said that, quote, the court was abandoning the court's duty to declare law, that the practices challenged in these cases imperil our system of government, and nothing is more important than free and fair elections. No, she was blistering in her attack. And there is real concern about what the impact will be if we just kind of say, okay, we'll let the, we'll just let the states do whatever they want to, because that didn't work out so well for us during Jim Crow era and in the early era of the Voting Rights Revolution. In fact, we can trace the court's entry into voting rights to a decision of Baker versus Carr in the early 1960s, where they said, gerrymandering is not a political question. It is very appropriate for the federal courts to decide. So that's why everybody kind of went, wow, that was quite a decision.
Kimmy, we have about a minute and a half left. There was a case that did come from Wisconsin. This was about whether or not police can draw blood to test for intoxication. If the person is passed out and can't give consent, what constitutional element did this case hinge on?
So it really is an issue regarding the exceptions to the warrant requirement part of why everyone is up in arms about the court reversing its precedent is that in McNeely versus Missouri, in a 2013 case, the court said, hey, modern technology has made it possible to get warrants quickly by the side of the road. There's no reason why you can't do that. In your Wisconsin case, it's because Wisconsin has an implied consent law, and that's what Wisconsin had argued all the way up. Look, when you get your license, you have impliedly consent to everything we need to do to you if there's a problem on the side of the road. And so they had asserted that in the lower court arguments. The court decided the case not based on implied consent, but based on exigent circumstances. And they said, look, if you're passed out from a DUI, then we can take your blood without a warrant. In the McNeely case, they said, no, you've got to get a warrant. But that person was awake and lucid. In your case, the person was passed out. Court says exigent circumstances apply. And so in many ways, what you're going to see is future law enforcement has been sent a signal that, look, just justify a warrantless search for exigent circumstances and you're going to be okay. Supreme Court said so in the Mitchell case.
Kimmy, that's all the time we have left for this conversation today. Thank you so much for joining us.
As always.
Kimmy King is a professor of political science at the University of North Texas, and she was with us to talk about U.S. Supreme Court decisions that were handed down yesterday.
Coming up, we reflect on the legacy of the Stonewall riots in New York 50 years later.
Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up, we'll get the latest Wisconsin news as part of our state news roundup.
Right now, 50 years ago today, a police raid on a gay bar in New York's Greenwich Village served as a turning point in the modern LGBTQ rights movement.
That raid led to what's been called the Stonewall Riots. While there are differing opinions about whether the uprisings around Stonewall ignited the modern movement for gay rights, the event remains a crucial moment in U.S. history.
Our next guest is here to talk about what Stonewall meant for the movement and what's changed for the LGBTQ community over the past 50 years.
Kong Pa is an assistant professor in the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies program at UW Eau Claire. Kong, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
So in part of our introduction, we mentioned some broad terms about what we do know about Stonewall. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of the common misconceptions about what happened at Stonewall?
Well, certainly. One of the things that I like to start with when talking about Stonewall is that there is a long history of LGBTQ activism and organizing that has preceded Stonewall. And there is a narrative that talks about Stonewall as that sort of watershed moment, that moment where everything sort of bursted and LGBT people started fighting back. And so one of the things that I would like to say is that there are a lot of events that really culminated in Stonewall happening on that night, June 28th, 1969, 50 years ago. And so part of what was mentioned earlier is that there has been a long history of police harassment and attacks and arrests on LGBTQ people, particularly those who are homeless, right? Transgender sex workers who are roaming the streets. And so that event really gave a way for LGBTQ people to say, you know, enough is enough. And that long history of harassment, that long history of repression, starting even in the 1940s and 50s really made Stonewall possible.
Sticking with some of the misconceptions, the visualization we all typically have in our head is that this was, you know, a masculine, gay, sort of white men event, but that isn't necessarily the case. Am I correct there?
Yes, there is a big misconception out there about who participated in Stonewall. And we can see in recent popular depictions of Stonewall, for example, like the recent movie that just came out on Stonewall, that involved cisgender white gay men who supposedly threw the first bricks. But historians and other scholars are really trying to push back on some of these narratives and say, hey, there are other actors and people who have been left out, right, of the narrative of Stonewall. And that includes people like Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera, who very recently were also announced that they were going to receive statues in Greenwich Village in New York. So that really attests to the pivotal roles and the central roles that transgender women of color have played, and that people are starting to recognize that by honoring the legacies of Johnson and Rivera.
Kong Pa is with us. He's an assistant professor in the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at UW Eau Claire. And we're talking about 50 years after Stonewall. And Kong, what are several things that have yet to change in the 50 years since those uprisings?
Well, this is a very good question because I teach about some of the unfinished legacies and continuing challenges that LGBTQ communities still face. One of the first thing that I really want to talk about is this misconception that policing has ended, right? And that very much is central to why Stonewall even happened in the first place and why we continue to celebrate Stonewall. And that, in fact, policing has not ended, and it has, in fact, intensified in so many different ways. There are many activisms and social movements out there, like Black Lives Matter, that are trying to bring that back to our attention, that, you know, policing or police harassment or police brutality or even prisons and all of these sorts of systems are still very much with us, right, and that we're still struggling with them. So that would be one thing that I would say is central to trying to tackle the misconception about Stonewall.
Why do you think that Stonewall in particular, when we think about the LGBTQ rights movement, of which there are many with many actors, has taken such a central role?
Well, one of the things that Stonewall did was that it ignited the public spectacle of the prevalence, right, of police brutality. And so that has been something that many people really have refused or have been unable to really fully grasp until Stonewall really showed us that this is a very prevalent, pervasive, sort of oppressive structure in American society. So the visibility of naming, right, these structures became powerful for how activists and advocates and even scholars can fight back. And so for many people, that is central, right? Central to naming the ways in which LGBT people are constantly surveilled by the state. And so Stonewall is central to that naming of the structure.
For some of our listeners, they might say, hey, you know, same-sex marriage is now legal nationwide. And for some, they think that that's kind of the last thing and now everything is okay. What should people take away still from the ongoing LGBT rights movement?
Certainly, the legalization of same-sex marriage was a huge moment in our history. I celebrate the legalization of same-sex marriage every day, right, since that day in 2015. And my students are very proud of that because they have been able to witness, right, this very moment. But when we dig deeper, I would say that there are still so much more that we have to talk about in terms of LGBTQ issues right now. One thing that I hear on the news all the time is about homelessness, right? That we know, according to various different surveys, and one website that I really like is the National Center for Transgender Equality, that reveals just in 2015-16 that there are so many transgender individuals who have experienced homelessness in their lifetime. And so this is a very much an LGBTQ issues that hasn't been resolved, that sort of has been swept under the rug because of the idea that the legalization of same-sex marriage represents the ultimate end to LGBTQ people's struggles.
In about 30 seconds, looking ahead to the century mark after Stonewall, how do you think we'll be talking about this?
Well, one thing that I think people would like to now, and hopefully we'll talk about more, is that Stonewall has given rise to other sort of social movements like Black Lives Matter or Me Too, and that these are very much integral to Stonewall's legacy. And so we can't really speak about Stonewall without speaking about modern contemporary social movements. And that's something that hopefully in a century, people will start to connect the dots and say that, wow, Stonewall really opened the doors for all of us to fight back against what keeps us oppressed, right?
Kong, thank you so much. Hate to cut you off. Kong Pa is an assistant professor at UW-Eau Claire, where he teaches gender and sexuality studies. We've all been there. There's a traffic jam on the highway, so we flip on the GPS to see if we can find another route to our destination. Sometimes it works, and sometimes it goes horribly wrong.
Airport-bound drivers in Colorado this week were instructed by Google Maps to take a detour. Unfortunately, the alternate route took drivers down a dirt road that rain had turned into a muddy mess. And, well, you see where this is going.
And when all is said and done, about 100 cars found themselves stuck on a muddy road, which ran through an empty field.
That reminded us of this classic scene from one of our favorite shows, The Office.
No, look. It means go up. To the right, bear right, over the bridge, and hook up with 307.
Make a right.
Maybe it's
turn.
A shortcut, Dwight. It said go to the right.
It can't mean that. There's
look,
a lake right there.
I think it knows where it is going.
This is the
lake. Machine knows.
This is the lake.
Stop yelling at me.
No, it's
stop
up there.
Yelling.
There's no road here.
And that's Michael Scott and Dwight driving into the lake there. And I think, the moral of the story is the machine is not always right.
Honestly, this sounds like me when I'm driving in the car. I've pretty much given way too much power to Google Maps. And pretty soon I'll find myself, I don't know, parked in a park, maybe?
The moon.
Yeah, just maybe Utah. Who knows? We'll get there eventually, but yeah.
I hope on your next trip to the airport you don't find yourself stranded on a muddy road somewhere.
Don't jinx me.
I'll call you an Uber if you do. This is Central Time.